This is the podcast for Wednesday, November 17th, 2010, Ethics. Oh, except for now I want to turn this around. I don't know if I dare. I've been jiggering my power cord to make sure it doesn't die on me. It's charging now. Maybe I can get it. If it goes off like that, I can get it to go on again. Some little crimping. I think it's around the edge here. Yeah, I might have to just go on the battery. I think it'll last through class here. That's a connector. If it would just die, I'm gonna have to stop on the way home or something. I almost ordered one last night. I was thinking, I might not get here in time because it's the last couple weeks of class. Sorry for that.
Okay. I have one if you want to
use it. Do you?
Yeah.
Could I just for a little bit? I'd appreciate that. Let's press pause here.
This is a good example of ethics.
Okay, so we were talking about Aristotle last time. And Aristotle has a teleological theory. A teleological theory is a theory with a purpose and a goal. So for Aristotle, there's a goal for morality. For Aristotle, the goal of morality is eudaimonia, or success. So sometimes the word eudaimonia is mistranslated happiness, and unfortunately in some of the more widely used translations it's translated happiness, but that is a mistranslation of eudaimonia. Because Aristotle says, well, some people think eudaimonia is this, and one of his possible explanations of what it is a life of pleasure. So pleasure or happiness and eudaimonia are not the same thing. He says some people consider it's the life of honor and glory. For other people, they think it's the life of the mind. And so he goes through different conceptions, and he finally comes up with his own conception. But eudaimonia is a kind of an abstract concept, and it's the concept of success. And so sometimes you get this awkward translation of human flourishing. But then the problem with this, plants and animals can have it. Happiness, no. Human flourishing, no. So success. He's talking about to be successful. And to be successful is, in Aristotle's mind, to actualize your potential. For the type of being you are. Potential. Or the type of being you are. So he thinks that to find out what you're intended to do, you need to find out what is your nature. And he thinks that human nature is something that's broad enough that you can define it. And so he says, once you decide what a human being is, what human nature is, you'll be able to figure out what the best life for a human being is. And he thinks about this in terms of what is your purpose as a human being? What were you meant to do? What were you designed to do? And he thinks about this in the same way we think about artifacts. You come across a hammer, and you think, well, what is a hammer? A hammer is a tool. What is its purpose? To pound nails. What makes it different from a screwdriver, right? Well, a screwdriver that takes a threaded piece of metal and screws it in, whereas the hammer pounds in the nail, which is not threaded. Because they perform different functions, different aspects of their design allows a certain aspect in a hammer makes it a poor device for screwing in screws, and vice versa. So in a pinch, you can take the handle of a screwdriver and pound a nail. I've done it before. And you might even be able to take the claw end of a hammer and kind of use it to screw in a screw if it's like one of those non-Phillips heads. But it's not very effective. And so he thinks if you look at a human being, you can ask those same questions. What do or any natural biological organism, you can ask, what is it? What does it do, and what aspects of its design allow it to perform that function well? And then you come up with a kind of idealized version of that being, and you say, okay, here's what the target is. Here's what I should aspire to be. And this fits in well with a lot of modern psychology that puts a lot of focus on role models. So Aristotle's idea is you think about what is the ideal life, and who is the ideal human being? What are some examples of ideal human beings? And then how can I aspire to be like that? But it all has to do with your purpose as a human being, your function as a human being. And so he starts out looking at what is a living thing, first of all. And he looks at different kinds of living things. And Aristotle is considered to be the first real biologist, and he's the person that came up with roughly the classification system we use today of species and differentia and kingdoms and islands and all that stuff came from Aristotle's work. And so he starts out talking about plants, and he says, you look at plants, what do the plants do? Well, they grow and they take in nutrients from the soil, nutrition. You look at animals, what do? Well, animals have all of the below. Oops. Plus, what do animals have that plants don't have? Yeah, respiration. Well, I mean, Aristotle didn't know this, but plants take in carbon dioxide and give off oxygen. I suppose you could see as a form of respiration. Think about this sort of if you look at a plant, what is it doing? Not like the scientific picture, but the more of the empirical observational picture of someone in Aristotle's time.
Just sitting there.
Animals have locomotion.
Locomotion, right. Moving from place to place. Now, people are going to, some wiseacre is going to say, I ought to be a flytravelant, the plant can't uproot itself and move from place to place. Unless you're playing Plants and Zombies or something, those plants and Plants and Zombies that have locomotion. Did the plants, or do they just grow really fast? I don't know. But the locomotion, and also perception. Now, what about humans? And actually, Aristotle would say man. And Aristotle, when he says man, he's really thinking about men, because he thinks about women as sort of and being in a class with slaves and people that have a slightly different role than I think we can kind of patch up the holes in Aristotle. Heidegger loved Hitler, but that doesn't mean that there isn't something worthwhile in his philosophy that we can pull out. He talked about man, and he is thinking in particular in his sexist way of just men, but maybe we could broaden it to think about human beings. So humans again have all of the below plus what? Well, what do we have the animals don't have?
Logic,
critical thinking.
Yeah, all those things can be described as being parts of rationality. So Aristotle's famous for defining man as a rational animal. So what is man? Man is an animal. He's a biological being with all the and just like any other animal, in that he has perceptions, he can move around, he has growth, nutrition. I forgot reproduction. That also belongs to the plants and the animals. So he grows, he eats, he reproduces, he perceives, he moves around. But unlike the other animals, he possesses rationality. And so Aristotle says man is a rational animal. Now notice there's nothing about, what about possesses an immortal soul? Aristotle doesn't believe in an immortal soul separate from the body. He thinks about, Aristotle actually doesn't say you don't have a soul. What he says is that the word soul is just a description of biological processes in the body, what we call consciousness. And the consciousness is produced by the body, and when the body dies, the soul dies too. There's a discussion of this in Plato's Republic where I think it's Simmias, one of Socrates' friend, suggests that maybe the soul is a kind of a harmony of the body, sort of like a musical instrument. And so when you play a musical instrument, the music comes from the instrument, the harmony. If you take the instrument and you bash it over the table, it's not going to make any more music anymore. And the music doesn't sort of exist in some place apart from the instrument that produces it. And so the same way, the body, pardon me, the body produces consciousness. But if the body is too badly damaged, it ceases to produce consciousness. So Aristotle's not really a materialist, but he's close to it. He believes in kind of God, but God to him is sort of an abstraction. But he thinks that human beings are material beings, and that consciousness is produced by the body. So in that way, he might see him as a sort of a modern, scientific sounding philosopher. So it's somewhat ironic that Christianity adopted Aristotle as a kind of patron philosopher saint in the Middle Ages, and Thomas Aquinas essentially used Aristotle and the Bible to create medieval philosophy. So man is a rational animal. So what, when you go to those questions about what is man? He's a rational animal. What's his purpose or function or characteristic activity? Well, you know, for a hammer, it's to pound nails. What do human beings do? Act rational. Does that seem right to you? Is that what you think about when you think about humans? Act rational. I suppose it depends on what you think about as being like act rational, right? Now, I think in the broadest sense of this, you might think, well, that's really true, because what do human beings do? They engage in goal-directed activity. So other animals, they act on instinct. They don't think about the future. They don't plan for the future. They don't have 401k plans. They don't anticipate painful experiences as much as we do, and they don't look forward to pleasurable experiences. So think about if you have a pet, right? Your pet doesn't wander someday I'm going to die, or I'm kind of getting old, I wonder what's going to happen, am I going to be able to jump over the fence like I always have? Whereas human beings really do think about those sorts of things. Human beings use tools, they build tools, they build things. So we, even though some of us might do it more than others, we engage in these kind of rational, goal-directed decision-making processes where we see something we desire and we try to figure out the means of achieving it. Some of us, more successful than others at it. And people tend to be better at some things than others as well. Questions or comments? So now what given that man is a rational animal, we're most suited to, and that's our characteristic activity, then Aristotle says our purpose is going to have something to do with rationality. It's going to have something to do with rationality, a goal-directed activity. So what you should do is something having to do with rationality. So Aristotle actually concludes that the best life, the ideal life, is, surprise, surprise, the life of the philosopher. The life, or you might say more broadly, the life of the mind. And now, he's a little different from Plato, in that Plato, who does believe that the body is the prison house of the soul, thinks that you could live off in a cave someplace, and as long as you had enough food to sustain your body, and as long as there are other people there to philosophize with, and actually the other people to philosophize with might even be optional, you could just like think about the eternal verities and you could have a good life, even if you're like living in a hovel. And Socrates was like this. Socrates was poor all his life. He would just wander out in the marketplace. There's a story, probably apocryphal, about Socrates' wife not wanting to go out and waste his time philosophizing in the marketplace. And I guess she wanted him to get a job or something, or stick around the house and help with the kids or whatever. Socrates' family was also destitute their whole lives. And Socrates prided himself on not taking any money for his teaching, with much to the chagrin of his family, right? Because he's like the celebrity guy, but he was a point of honor for him that he never took money for his teaching. So even though he was like one of the most famous people in Athens, his family was still in the poorhouse. Anyway, so the story is that his wife would hide his robe to keep him from going out, and Socrates would just go out naked to philosophize. And for Plato, I think, that was that you could have a good life, a philosophy. Now, Aristotle's a little more of a realist, than he, so he thinks the ideal life is, when I say more broadly, the intellectual life. Because remember, philosophy isn't just what we think about philosophy today. There was natural philosophy, which was essentially the ancient version of science. There was, you think about all the different branches of knowledge, of being a doctor and being a physician. I think of some of the other, so you could be like a biologist, a physicist, and in the ancient world, how these things aren't really sophisticated. You could be maybe an architect. That's a little more kind of crafty, I suppose. A scholar of some kind, an historian. And all those are kind of intellectual pursuits. And so the intellectual life is the ideal life. The life of the scholar or the philosopher. But he also thought that you needed a few things in addition to this. So you needed enough money to be comfortable. You got to have servants. Why do you need servants? Well, while you're philosophizing, you need a slave boy to pour the wine and to make, fresh comments about, right? And you need... you need someone to cook your food, and you need someone to clean your house, and because that's all time you could have been spending philosophizing, right? You need decent looks, because you can't be ugly or deformed. Why? Because no one's going to want to philosophize with you. And Aristotle says a lot of things, these things you can control, but sometimes it's just like bad luck, right? You're born like really, really ugly. I'm trying to think of some celebrity. He was like a really ugly celebrity. That's someone that's like really famous. There's a few of them. Like Keith Richards. Right? That guy's like scary looking. Or what? No, what's his name? The guy from Aerosmith.
Steve Tyler.
Steve Tyler.
Or Mick Jagger. I don't know what it is of these rockers with like these kind of bizarre bulbous features with like the big lips and the kind of weird looking. Yeah, but so that like you could like look kind of weird or what about what's going on with that Willem Dafoe guy? Right, he's like he played Nosferatu the vampire and didn't even need any makeup. And he was like the Green Goblin and they didn't need to do much for him there either. So the idea is that you don't want to like scare your friends off. Like that, there's that movie with Mel Gibson, Man Without a Face, where he's like this guy with a horribly disfigured face, and he's kind of like lives on the edge of town, and people are kind of afraid of him, and little children run from him. That's not the way to have a good life. And also, you need friends. And so a lot of this has to do with this idea you need friends to philosophize with. And human beings, Aristotle also says, are social animals. So part of being rational is having other individuals to have relationships with, to work together with, to philosophize with. So if you have money, good looks, and a bunch of friends, and you spend all your time philosophizing, that is the ideal life for Aristotle. What do you think? Is he right?
He doesn't sound too bad.
Yeah, I can live with that.
I'm not sure that necessarily he, again, like, not necessarily philosophizing, but I think he thinks you ought to do something with your mind. You ought to do something intellectual. And it's not like you can have an okay life as, like, you know, maybe like a bricklayer as long as, you know, or that you couldn't have even a good life as a slave. You might have an okay life. But it would be like the difference between, I don't know, having a decent life and having like the perfect life. And he thinks this is the perfect life. Yeah.
I think that underneath that his idea, he basically admits that it's impossible for everybody to have an ideal life or everybody to have a great, you know, basically. So I don't know. Sure, because it seems like if this is ideal life, then only probably what, 10% at most have ideal life. I mean,
right.
You can't have ideals
I think Aristotle would say that the idea that everybody can have the ideal perfect life or something close to it is unrealistic because you know, you're always going to need like people. It's like the idea that you could have a college institution that was all professors. You know, you got to have somebody there with the financial aid to fill out the boring forms, and you got to have like, you know, the janitors to empty the waste baskets. What am I going to empty the waste baskets? I'm a professor. That takes away from my time philosophizing. So the idea that people don't empty their own waste baskets, you know, was beyond Aristotle. So who does that work? You know, women, slaves, you know, people of lesser capacity. And so the idea is like if I brought in like, you know, Larry the custodian said, okay, Larry, I'm going to take it easy today. Why don't you take over class today? I mean, he wouldn't know what to do, right? He'd tell you about how to make plywood or something, which he knows an awful lot about, or maybe he'd bring in his antique watches. So, I mean, Larry's not... Larry's a smart guy in his own way, but he's not good at philosophizing and sort of abstract thinking. But he's really good at getting stuff clean. So the idea is you want people to do things suited to their station. Now me, you see my office, I'm lousy at cleaning. Right? So you wouldn't want me as a janitor. And so, but Larry's like probably the most conscientious employee here at Lane Community College. And he's really good at his job. And so Aristotle says you need certain people for certain jobs. And everybody can't be, you know, everybody can't have the ideal life. Boss, what do you think? Yeah.
Well, how does that make Larry any less moral, though, than Aristotle?
Well, that's an interesting thing. I think Aristotle might say, like, as a human being, maybe Larry just sort of the luck of the draw, that he can only aspire to certain heights, and he can fulfill his own potential as much as he wants. Like he can be the best damn custodian, you know, on the West Coast or whatever. And I think he probably comes pretty close. And so you think about a person that does a certain job; they can be really good at what they do. But if you, I think Aristotle would say, look, you take like a custodian or someone who like works in a laundry or a waitress, and you put them next to like Stephen Hawking or next to you know, a famous writer or Steven Spielberg, or just like an artist, a writer, a scholar, a musician, a scientist. Are you going to say these people are equal, that they're equally valuable? And he'd say that's kind of crazy. That obviously that people who excel are people we admire, and these are people, generally speaking, he would say they have the life of the mind. Because that's what makes us human, right? It's our capacity to think. And so those who think the most are the best. And who thinks the most? The philosophers and, you know, intellectuals in general. I still think he thinks about philosophers who do what we think about as philosophy today as being the top of the pile. Like he might think about historians as not being quite as, you know, good. Artists, Aristotle's theory of art, I think it's not as bad as Plato's, but he doesn't think about artists as being on par either with the scholars and intellectuals. I don't know. Other thoughts? Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I think if you put Larry next to, say, Mel Gibson, who fancies himself as some kind of philosopher, I think Larry would probably win out in the minds of most people.
Okay, let me dig on Mel Gibson there.
Oh, yeah.
What did you think about Apocalypto? Yeah, that was kind of interesting then.
It was.
So the thing about like great arts is it's all, you know, feet of clay, and you look at these people in their personal life, they tend to be tumultuous, and people don't really live up to their own values,
right.
And leave foolish voicemails. Let's see, what else? He's got a really great script. I don't know if that's going to get... I don't know if they've made this yet. It's called The Beaver. It's about a guy who goes all psycho with his hand puppet. And it's kind of like a remake of that movie Magic with Anthony Hopkins. Except for instead of with a ventriloquist dummy, it's with a beaver puppet. I read the script. It actually looks pretty good. But who knows if we'll ever get a distributor because of all his craziness out there in the public. Okay, tangent. So the idea, like, now how about this idea that, you know, we talked about this with John Stuart Mill, that this is kind of an elitist intellectual snob version of the ideal life, and maybe the ideal life is like the life of, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, or having like a you know, decent job, good family life, you know, and a life of pleasure, and not necessarily, you know, use your mind too much. Like most of the people I know who are intellectuals aren't particularly happy, or particularly well adjusted for that matter. Like, who are the people that seem to like be the happiest, that feel like subsistence farmers in Ecuador, seem to live the longest, they have the lowest stress, the fewest worries? There's a story about some guy that, he's like a businessman. He visits some Latin American village, and there's a guy going out there in his little boat, and he's out there for just a few minutes, and his boat is like filled with fish. And he brings them in, and he's like, you know, if you worked at it, you could have a fishing business. You could take like some tourists out here, you could build kind of like a fishing lodge, and then pretty soon you'd be like rolling dough, and then you could be like the head of your own like Fortune 500 company after like 15 or 20 years. Now, you'd have to work at it, and you couldn't waste all your time fishing, but you'd have like this great, you could be like something, you could be somebody. And the guy said, well, so after I, and then he's like, well, after that, I'm a millionaire. I got my own, you know, Fortune 500 company based on like a giant fish export company. What do I do after that? He's like, well, then you finally, you sell out, you retire, and you can kick around in some, you know, place like this, and just spend all your time fishing and hang out with your friends. And he says, well, that's what I'm doing now. Right, so why would I go to this rigmarole for 20 or 30 years of pain in order to do what I'm doing now? And so you might think that the ideal life might be, you know, living low on the hog, as it were, and living a simple life of appreciating the simple pleasures of life, of friends and family and a job that you like, and maybe not thinking too much about things. Because you think of, it's like the book of Ecclesiastes says, with much knowledge comes with much knowledge comes much sorrow. Now, the making of books, there is no end. And with much knowledge comes sorrow. There's a famous essay by Krishnamurti where he talks about this. Krishnamurti wrote this essay on education where he talked about how great it is. And there's another essay by, I think, Voltaire, which talked about the fact that the more you think about life, the worse your life gets. Because you're always thinking, you know, you're staring at the ceiling thinking, what's the meaning of life? Is there a God? My life seems empty. Whereas, like, the person doesn't think too much. They wake up in the morning and they say, oh, it's a beautiful day, the sun's shining. What am I going to do today? I got my lovely wife and my kids, and I'm going to play with my kids, and I'll go out fishing for a little bit, and then I'll go check out my crops, and then I'll take go see my friends down at the pub, and then I'll take my siesta, and then maybe I'll go out and fish for my dinner, and then I'll enjoy a nice meal and strum on my guitar and fall into a restful sleep. Well, you know what? Doesn't that seem like an ideal life? You wouldn't be exercising your mind that much, but a lot of people aspire for that kind of life. They think, oh, well, I'm like maybe when I'm 65 or 70, if I could ever, you know, get half the value of my retirement account up there, I can, you know, retire someplace. I don't know, kind of a babbling on. What do you think? Is the life of the mind overrated? The sort of intellectual. Is there something to be said for the simple life? Where, oh, remember that this, actually somebody posted this on the forums. Better Socrates dissatisfied than pig satisfied. Well, how about someone want to give a defense of the life of a pig? No? Let's take a vote here. So how many people here? Oh, go ahead.
Doesn't Mark Twain write something about that? Like, after he's learned, you know, say being a doctor, you don't look at somebody the same way. It's looking at their skin. You used to look at their rosy skin, and now you're looking at what kind of disease they have. And in the river, the same way. Instead of seeing all the swirls and the markers in the river, you're looking at it, you know, in a totally different perspective. Same with anything in life. You know, the basics, and when you learn more, you know, it's fun. You're learning maybe a little more dangerous than you should be when you learn the harmful effects of different things. So then you kind of back off, or you're afraid for a little while until you learn even more. But maybe there's a curve.
Yeah, so maybe that you sort of, you appreciate things the more you know about them, but then also you worry and obsess about things maybe you never even thought about too. We have three hands up here. I'm going to lose first. Let's start from the front and we'll work our way back. You, sir.
I probably would go a little bit more with the intellectual life and, you know, the higher pleasures, I guess you would say. And that's just because, I mean, as you start to get into the higher pleasures and, you know, you start thinking about, like, abstract concepts and things like that, you can actually reach a point where simplicity in itself becomes something that is enjoyable. And I mean, while yes, a pig's always going to have simplicity, and so the pig could always be easily satisfied, if you're able to attain at least enough, you know, harmony in yourself and enough self-awareness in yourself, then you can just gain the same amount of pleasure as that pig, enjoying the simplicity of life. But you also have the ability to go and enjoy the more complex things. Like he was saying, how the river looks different depending on what you know about, you know, what you know about life, basically. Well, if you only know to look at it and see the swirls, then all you're going to ever see is the swirls. Well, what if you can look at it, see the swirls, and also see the technical stuff behind it, like, you know, what kind of stuff is living in it, what kind of habitat it is. You know, so you have more options open to you.
Yeah.
I think ignorance is bliss, because if you look at it, like, in the world today, somebody that's just a simple farmer or something doesn't care, compared to somebody that watches the news, global warming, all this bad information dictates action on your part, and it gets exhausting. You know, you just, there's too many fights out there.
Somebody saw my email, you know, I think I put it up there when I emailed something to myself, and somebody said, oh, the 50,000 messages in my inbox or something like that. It's like, well, I get them, and I just kind of click on a few of them, and I sign up for all these lists. Oh, this looks interesting, you know, and pretty soon it's like, it feels like I'm always behind, and I'm thinking, I wake up in the morning, think, oh, I get some work done, start out, and then sick, and I'm like, all right, well, I'll drink my coffee here. And pretty soon 2 hours goes by, and it's like, you know, 2 hours have gone into like Facebook and the Twitters and the you know, reading the news. And you think about like how much effect does it have on my life. And then I get really interested in something like, what was it? There was like an anti-Nazi group in World War II called the Society of the White Rose, I think. And it was really interesting, and I'm reading about that. How much effect does that have practically on my life? You know, not a lot. I'm kind of interested. I want to understand like quantum physics and M theory and all that stuff. But how much? Again, it's brain racking stuff to try to understand these things. So maybe it'd be better for me to just like not aspire to understand, but just to relax and enjoy the world and not worry about the things too much. And people do the politics, but especially, I think. And those are good points. Yeah.
On the defense of the pig's life, I mean, there's a lot more depressed philosophers, scientists, etc., than there are depressed pigs. Mm-hmm. So since it's the basis for a utilitarian type of theory, it seems like there's a lot more pain on the intellectual side and a lot more pleasure on the side of the pig. So just from that standpoint,
right,
it seems like it's self-defeating.
I think I mentioned this, like working with the you know, developmentally disabled adults, they seem some of the happiest people on the planet. And it's like when you're a kid. And it depends on like what kind of childhood you have. Some people have rough childhoods, but you know, most people they have decent childhoods. Look back at, you know, summer vacations they had and playing and not having a lot of responsibility, and they think, ah, that was a great life. And as you get older, you get more risky. I look back at my college days, like as an undergrad, as a kind of a carefree existence. And as you go through life, you get more and more things kind of get loaded up on top of you. Family and responsibilities and financial stuff. And then maybe you've got some assets, you got some investments to manage. And then pretty soon you spend all your time going to meetings and, you know, fixing up your house and all the stuff people do. Where they just keep on adding things. And maybe, and I think particularly though, when Aristotle talks about the life of the mind, that, you know, working your mind all the time seems like it would be kind of exhausting too. So I don't know. I usually get stronger reactions from students that will say, you know what I like to do? I like to watch football. And every once in a while, I might want to read a book for a change, but I like watching football, I like listening to rock and roll, I like off-roading on my Chevy, and every once in a while, I like to smoke up a bowl. And that's my life, and I love it, you know. And the idea that I'm not like a fully fledged human being, because I don't always have my nose in a book, or I'm not always trying to figure out the nature of reality, is foolish. So what do you think about that sort of view? Is that a short-sighted view, or is that, in other words, could it be, is it just a matter of subjective taste, or is there something to be said for that really a life where you fully engage your mind and is really a better life? Because that's really what makes us human, is using the mind. Yes?
Well, you say that Aristotle used to just walk around the market.
Socrates.
Yeah. And the philosophy and stuff like that. Like, that doesn't sound bad if you just get to go walk around and think and talk and stuff. But he's not working or, you know, being productive and having a life and stuff like that, where now you have to, and a lot of people do use your mind and stuff to have a job, or, you know, you can go and have your family and your kids, and yes, and just kind of go into flow, but you're still working. So it's like, yeah, if you could just philosophize, that'd be awesome, and walk around and talk and chat and blah, blah, blah. But people can't do that. You have to actually be productive. And so
yeah.
Like that's kind of.
Maybe I'm conflating a couple of things. So maybe I'm conflating like the demands of modern life with the intellectual life. And so Plato actually wanted to separate out those things and say that you could have an intellectual life without having a kind of a busy kind of materialistic life. Now what Aristotle says is basically, well, this has to do with this idea of moral luck, which is that you got to be lucky enough to be born in a proper station, or actually in Aristotle's case, find something you can do for money that's intellectual. And so Aristotle actually was kind of like, he was an academic. So actually the academy the word academic and the academy comes from Plato, who was his teacher. And so Aristotle was essentially a professor and a tutor, and that's how he made his money and how he afforded things, because he wasn't born into a lot of wealth. Yeah.
Well, it just seems like the life of Socrates and the retired manner are similar, where mm-hmm. as you were saying, one or the other, but they sound a lot alike.
Yeah, maybe so. Well, I think with Socrates, the difference there is like the guy who hangs out with his friends at the bar and drinks wine and strums on the guitar and has a siesta every day and fishes for his own supper, that he's not really doing anything intellectual. He's just he's living the life of people, lived in the Middle Ages, right? And he doesn't watch TV news, he doesn't read a bunch of books. He just kind of like lives off the earth and has his family and friends and enjoys life.
And so perhaps he still enjoys life. Like he does, have deep conversations with his friends at the bar and stuff.
Okay, well, I suppose.
And he appreciates it, and he sees the deep meaning and everything in the land and in the water through the fish.
So maybe you could kind of combine both. Like you'd have a life where you're not sort of in the rat race, but you're still using your mind in some ways. Yeah.
If Socrates was alive today, he'd be considered a deadbeat dad.
Yeah, I think so, right.
Well, and if he's exposed.
Yeah.
Right, he's right. He'd probably be arrested. Maybe not in Eugene. There was like, or Berkeley or someplace. I picture Socrates like wandering around the Berkeley campus. You'd be right home there. There was some guy in Berkeley who would walk around naked just to make a point. And I think Berkeley didn't have a nudity ordinance, and so he was like untouchable, like according to the laws. So, funny little case. Anyway, Aristotle also had this talk about this phenomena, which is kind of interesting. If you have a teleological system, it's called a moral luck. And this is this last thing here. So, Aristotle, again, being a realist, says the ideal life is a life of a mind. Being a scholar, being an intellectual, being a philosopher. You need certain things. You gotta have friends, you can't be scary looking, you have to have money for food and servants. And also, if you're spending your entire day pushing a plow or laying bricks, you're not doing intellectual work. And so that's that. And so, you also have to make sure you avoid serious illness or financial ruin. And sometimes these things can't be avoided. So Aristotle thinks like the following. If you end up with you have think of something you might have, some kind of a long-term illness like arthritis, or you might have, diabetics, a mild form of diabetes that didn't kill you or something like that. Some people have that. Or just, get cancer or something like that. If you get cancer at 40, your life's going to be cut short and your last few years are going to suck. And that's, there's nothing you really could have done to avoid it, but that's just sort of bad luck. And so whether your life turns out to be ideal or not is in part a matter of luck. And so he thinks with virtue, you can increase your probability of having a good life, but there's no guarantee. You can do all the right things, and circumstance can screw up all your plans, and you can have a life that really sucks. And, you know, Aristotle had problems like this when he seemed to do all the right things, and then there was a coup in the Macedonian government, and he was associated with King Philip of Macedon, and he had to get out of town. And he said that instead of staying to fight, he said he slipped out of town in the middle of the night, lest Athens sin against philosophy twice. And so it sinned against philosophy the first time by killing Socrates, who was the father of philosophy. And Aristotle thinks that if they would have killed him, that would be sinning against philosophy the second time. So he got out of town. So you never know when something like that might happen. And again, he thinks that you could do all the right things and have something bad happen to you anyway. So some criticisms of Aristotle. One thing you can ask is, do natural things really have purposes? You know, you can look at a hammer, you can say, what's the hammer for? Well, the hammer is for what people designed it to do. And so when you're talking about an artifact, it has a purpose. But when you're talking about like a frog, and you say, well, what do frogs do? And you say, well, they hop around and eat flies, and so that's what the frog's meant to do. So the best frog is the frog that is the best at catching flies and the best at hopping around. It seems to be a little different talking about living organisms, that you have to talk about a designer or a god that sort of designed everything. And then, can you really discover the purpose of a thing just by looking at what it does? You can look at something and say, this is what it tends to do, this is how it behaves, but can you really say, this is what it was meant to do? The whole idea of something having a purpose or saying something is meant to be a certain way seems to apply someone who meant it to do that. Yeah.
Kind of reminds me of from The Little Mermaid, the little seagull. Then Ariel would go to see him and stuff, and he would have all these different things, and he would say it was like, he had a pipe, and he said it was like a dingle hopper or something, and it was from blowing, like making music or something. So, I mean, it's like, yeah, unless you actually know what it was made for, you could pretty much come up with that anything could be used for anything.
Uh-huh. And then, if human beings really do have purposes, are they all the same? Maybe the purpose of someone with a, you know, overdeveloped brain might be to do brain stuff, but maybe a person with just like a normal brain, maybe they should only think some of the time. Why should it be what makes you different that's sort of your purpose? In other words, just because our distinguishing feature is this goal-directed activity, does that mean that we ought to aspire to be as rational as possible, and the most rational life is the best life? And there's this whole the idea that reason is what human beings do best or characteristically. You might say maybe it's seek happiness, you know, using reason. Is reason really have its primary role? So it seems that there are a bunch of different ways you might try to get at Aristotle's view. The teleological nature of things, natural things having purposes, seems to be a pretty tough criticism to overcome. What fish were meant to swim in the sea. Well, fish do swim in the sea, and that's how they evolved to act. But the idea that they were meant to do that, and that the best fish is the fish that swims, you know, the most efficiently or something, seems a kind of strange way of talking. Unless you're, again, thinking about God designing fish to be a certain way. Although, you know, people talk about dog breeding this way. Like, when you're, like, looking at a dog show and you look at, like, a pug, but there's, like, breed standards, and the pug is graded by the breed standards of what the ideal pug is. And so the judge has in his mind some vision of the ideal pug, and then he looks at this particular pug and sees how it matches up. And this, you know, includes some sort of notion of an ideal kind of living being. And this is sort of what Aristotle is thinking about.
I was going to say, doesn't this kind of violate the ought is?
A good point, yeah. So he's saying that here he's describing the nature of, you know, living things, and he's saying that because living things are this way, described this way, this is how you ought to be. So if you are, suppose you are designed a certain way. Suppose we have like, I'm thinking about, okay, like Bender the robot from Futurama, right? What does Bender do? He bends things, right? So that's his function, he bends things. But if you imbue Bender with consciousness, Bender, because he's designed to bend things, he likes to bend things. But he also likes to cause trouble, make smart athlete comments, and get into trouble, you know, cause trouble. And so like Bender does all sorts of things besides bending things. And what if Bender says, well, you know, I don't know if I like bending stuff so much anymore. I'm kind of bored with it. I want to become a chef, right? Even though he was designed to bend things and to be like an industrial worker robot, does that mean that that's what the only thing he should aspire to be, or that he can't do something other than the thing he's best suited for? So in other words, just because human beings might be best suited for the life of the mind, does that mean that's the ideal life or the life you should pursue? Virtue. Let's talk about virtue. So, Aristotle's theory is called virtue theory, and we have to define what is virtue. So, the Greek word for virtue is arete. It's a virtue is a disposition of character which leads to success. A disposition of character which leads to success. So, what is a disposition? Well, disposition is just a tendency to act in a certain way. So, if you say a person is of a calm disposition, that means that, John Adams. I was just reading the story about John Adams, and he had this idea of the division of the government into the executive, the legislative, and judicial branches. Thomas Paine, for some reason, thought this was a horrible idea, probably because Thomas Paine didn't think of it first. And so he went and, according to John Adams, railed against him in a loud, vociferous voice in a most ungentlemanly manner. And Adams says he laughed at him heartily, right? So that shows that he is of a calm and maybe jovial disposition. Because when faced with a person yelling and screaming and carrying on, he just laughs at the guy and says, you know, and sort of laughs it off. If you were to say, and Thomas Paine, on the other hand, was at doing what Thomas Paine was. Thomas Paine was of an excitable, a very excitable disposition, which meant that he tended to carry on. He was prone to extreme moods, and particularly moods of anger and wrath. And offense. So people have dispositions to act in certain ways, which means that if they were in certain circumstances, they would tend to act in certain ways. So. I'm good. I think I got enough to get to do the next 14 minutes. Everybody got that? A disposition is a tendency to act in a particular way. You might add under certain, particular circumstances. So, more particularly, a virtue is a mean between extremes. And what extremes? The extremes of excess and deficiency. Too much of something and not enough of something else. So take the virtue of courage. What Aristotle thinks with the virtue of courage, you're going to have too much on one side, and that's going to be a vice. And then you're going to have courage as a virtue. And then you're going to have a deficiency, which is not enough. And the virtue is going to be someplace in the middle between excess and deficiency. So what's involved here is fighting. So courage is the right amount of fighting at the right time. So you got to know when to attack and when to retreat, when to stand and fight, and when to run away to fight another day. And so we're on the mean between a bunch of fighting and say this is 50%, right? So here you fight half the time and you run away half the time. So would this be where courage would be? Fight, would a courageous person be a person who roughly ran away half the time and roughly fought half the time? No, it'd be more over here, right? It'd be more towards excess, the excess. So someplace, now the excess is what you might call foolhardiness or brashness is more opposed to pride. Berserker. You're like a berserker or something like that. You're the guy that no matter what the odds are, and no matter the tactical position you're in, you just take your sword and you run into the arrows and you go ah, and you're not using your head, so you're just being foolhardy. Yeah.
Where were utilitarians? Where on this scale would they be not enough all the way to the left because it produce non-happiness?
Yeah, I think that utilitarians would say, what would they say about this? I think it would depend on the utilitarians. Like they would, some utilitarians think that, what would they say? They would say knowing when to fight and when to run away is something you should sort of calculate. So they say in a particular situation, you could say, okay, what are the odds? What's my position? And then what would happen if I went out and attacked right now? Like, would I get shot? Would I get feathered with arrows? Would people throw rocks at me? Would I be bathed in boiling oil? What would happen? And then what if I run away? What would happen then? And then you sort of weigh the odds either way and figure out what would produce the best consequences. Aristotle says you can't do that. He thinks that you might do that a little bit at first, but after a while you're just going to know. And so like if you have a seasoned soldier, he's going to know when it's time to get the hell out of there. And he's going to know when it's time to hold the position. And if he's a commander, he's good at making those decisions. He's going to know when he needs to maybe have some guys keep their position, even though he knows he's going to lose some soldiers, and when it's time to cut his losses and beat a hasty retreat. And that can only come through personal experience. So the utilitarians think that you can kind of calculate all that out in your mind, whereas Aristotle says you really can't quantify judgment. And it's not like I could give somebody a book like how to be brave or a book on military tactics, and the person could read it and then they could say, okay, I'm ready to go. You need to have some field experience. And that's where he says really courage is something that has to be learned. And so you can see it's more over here. It's more towards excess, the excess, and farther away from the deficiency. But both of these are vices. So it's a vice, and what do we call this vice over here? Cowardice, right? And this is foolhardiness. Which reminds me of the quote from Gilligan, I'm not a coward, I just faint at the sight of my own blood. So cowardice, though, is a vice. But foolhardiness is a vice, too. These are on the extremes. You want to be, it's sort of like the three bears, right? You want to be right in the middle, like not too hot, not too cold, but just right. Someplace in the middle, although not always like right in the middle, often towards one side or the other. And how do you know where the point is? Personal experience, practice, judgment. Remember, morality is a skill. And so being courageous is a skill that you learn going through life and trying to be brave, trying to act courageously. You pick it up as you go along.
So that means that according to him, the quality which does not have any excess is not virtue, right? For example, luck, because you have too much luck. It's like, so the luck is not the virtue, even though he requires it for this perfect luck.
Yeah, and so, I mean, luck is kind of a separate thing. You have the virtues are characteristics of a person. And I think he doesn't really think of luck isn't really a characteristic of a person. It's more of a characteristic of the world. And so sometimes bad luck will happen to you, but it's not something you can control. Whereas the virtues are characters you can develop in yourself, which will allow you to prosper unless you get really unlucky.
How about I score or curse you with something you really value?
Pardon me?
It's like scholastic pursuits, like scholastic inquisitiveness. I mean, like excess, like, oh, you just want to study too much, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, unless you go into the chronicle where you like ignore your food and sleep and you just die. I mean, outside of chronicle examples, there is no excess either.
Well, you could say, like, you might say, like, okay, thinking. Now, Aristotle thinks the idea of life is the life of the mind. But what if you neglect, like, eating and drinking, and all you're doing is thinking? I mean, if you heard someone say, you know what the problem with you? You think too much, right? Hey, so that, yeah, it seems like you can't think too much. So, but maybe, like, the thinking that the mean is maybe, again, maybe he would say it belongs over here. So here, you would say, like, an egghead, or, you know, overly intellectual, or, that's the word people say, you overly analyze things, right? Where, and Aristotle actually says that, you know, practical judgment is important, and that to always engage in abstract reasoning, you know, is going to get you into trouble. And then the deficiency here would be like, you know, a dullard or a, you know, a moron or something, right? I'm not sure what the word, but a person who never thinks about anything. Yeah.
What about the guy that got the Medal of Honor yesterday who ran into two-sided fire to save this guy, getting hit by bullets? Aristotle would consider him, or that being foolhardiness.
Yeah, I think he would say that like, you know, he was it posthumously awarded? Or did he make it? He's alive?
He's the first one.
Well, he must, I mean, you might say, well, he did the right thing. If he, I think...
Yeah, he survived and right. So he gets medal, but...
But part of that has to do with your objective, like how important the objective is versus the personal sacrifice. So it doesn't mean you would never sacrifice yourself. You might sacrifice yourself, but the idea is you wouldn't want to sacrifice yourself for nothing. So if you had a 1% chance of saving your 10 friends who had a 99% chance of dying, and then you had a 99% chance of dying trying to save them, then that would be foolhardy. But, you know, maybe if you had like a 50-50 chance, you should go for it. Yeah.
On that topic, he saved a soldier that was shot 7 times from being taken by the Afghans. The soldier ended up dying, which he knew that he probably was, but in essence, he anyways, no soldier left behind kind of thing.
Right.
That was pretty amazing. So
I think Aristotle would say, you should try to take, you know, you should try to get the bodies of your soldiers, but, you know, there are some cases where it'd be foolhardy. And it just depends. Aristotle would say in a lot of these things, it depends on the situation. Like you get someone like the utilitarian or the consequentialist who wants to say, okay, well, let's look at this, you know, and analyze the situation and what should you do in this kind of situation. And Aristotle would always say, well, it's always going to depend on this particular situation and you can't second guess the commanders on the ground. And there's something you can do practically which can't be explained in a book or in abstract principles. Do you have a question or comment?
I was just going to say, I would think that Aristotle would categorize that more as foolhardy, but with a good dose of luck.
Okay, that could be it too, sure. Yeah, you might have that interpretation as well. Just a couple of these other virtues. So, a couple of things about virtue. Virtue is learned through good upbringing and then practice it as an adult. So your upbringing sets the, gives you a foundation. And then later on, you can kind of fine-tune it with practice. So Aristotle thinks that upbringing is really important because if your parents punish you when you do things like steal and lie and do other bad things and they reward you for doing good things, then as an adult, it's going to be easier for you to do the right things. You'll be habituated to have, you'll have a good character. You'll be habituated to doing the things which will make you prosperous. Having integrity, keeping promises, being a loyal friend, being industrious, and then you'll avoid the bad things like being, not having any self-control, becoming a drunk, you won't become a drunkard or a glutton and ruin your health. And so he thinks that having good habits, and you think about things today, good nutrition and brushing your teeth and, all the sort of kind of pedestrian things that you learn as a kid, in addition to things we think about more as moral. And then, so you build on that as an adult. And then as an adult, you're sort of fine-tuning those things. You learn through trying to learn self-discipline or trying to act in a disciplined way. And you look at people that they try to quit drinking or smoking, and usually they fall off the wagon a couple times before they finally get it right. And so the idea is you kind of practice, you try different things, you assert your will to try to solve some character defect and or to try to figure out what the right thing to do is in a hard situation. And over time, you get wisdom comes with experience and age. So a couple other virtues. So what about honesty? So the virtue of honesty. What's the deficiency?
Liar.
Yeah. And then what's the excess?
The guy that tells the murderer about his friend in the closet.
Okay, yeah. The commentator that says my friend's hiding in the closet. So sometimes people are like brutally honest or too honest. Like in that movie Liar Liar with Jim Carrey, where he always has to tell the truth. And there's some cases where you don't want to tell somebody the truth. You don't want to like you meet Steven Tyler for the first time and say, "I love your music, but you're the ugliest man I've ever seen," or whatever. And maybe, or yeah, tell your wife that she looks fat, or So you think about there's cases where you might want to sort of massage the truth or kind of say it in a kind of nice way. So again, it's going to be over here. The mean maybe is going to be way over here. How about moderation? Or moderation or temperance?
Oh, God.
Moderation would have to be 50-50.
Right? All good things in moderation.
Yeah, well, it seems like that should go right here.
Should be moderately moderate.
Right. I can't remember. I think it was.
Americans are too moderate.
What's his name? Oscar Wilde, I think the guy said moderation is for monks, or temperance is for those with insufficient imagination. I know, and here he's thinking about not too much eating and drinking. So the excess, you could be a drunkard or a glutton, but what about the deficiency for moderation?
Malnourished.
You'd be like, anorexic or, malnourished or a kind of a... There's some people that they just don't eat enough, and yeah.
I believe the other excess would be misery.
Yeah, misery, right.
Well, because it's derived from the term miser, basically to not overindulge in anything, but to be tight with everything. So you have excess on one side and misery on the other.
Right. And, people look at, somebody can't enjoy their liquor, it's a teetotaler who's, sort of, has something about being able to enjoy drink it now and again. That Aristotle, I think, would say that that's you got a problem there too if you're just drinking water while everybody else is enjoying the wine. So again, all things in moderation. Aristotle would agree with that. So he thinks for everything there's going to be some sort of mean between the extremes. Now, an interesting thing about Aristotle is there's no distinction between the good life and the natural and moral senses. So to have a successful life is to have a good life. To have a morally good life is to live the good life. And it's not like Kant, where you could have a good life and be a bad person. That if you're having a good life and that you're some kind of an intellectual and you've got enough money and friends and you're happy and you're healthy and you can control yourself and that's the good life, you're also a good person in the moral sense too. Whereas with Kant, you could have all those things and be a bad person if you weren't living according to the correct moral principles. So virtue again means doing something in the right amount at the right time. We talked about, let's see. Oh, pride. Pride is a virtue.
It is?
Pride is a virtue. Now, in Christianity, pride is sin. For Aristotle, pride is a virtue. And pride is a mean between being a braggart and being a... What's the sin for Aristotle? You know the deficiency.
Humility.
Nothing worse than humility. And what Aristotle says, if you accomplish something, you know, you should brag about it. If you really did it. That what you shouldn't do is brag about things you didn't really do. Like you shouldn't say, well, I was the, you know, captain of the Harvard swim team and I fought in Vietnam, if you didn't really do those things. Or if you can't even swim, but especially if you're running for political office. But if you really were captain of the Harvard swim team and you really did fight in Vietnam, then go ahead and tell people that, particularly if you like won a medal or something. So like Babe Ruth or somebody said that them that they have the right to brag, let them brag. And so Aristotle would agree with that, and he thinks that there's something wrong with you if you just like you like win a big football game or something like that, and you kind of kick the dirt with your toes and say it wasn't me, it was the Lord Jesus Christ working through me. I'm just a conduit of God's power or something. That you should take credit for it, and to put it off on God or to try to downplay your accomplishments shows that you lack self-esteem and that you're not a fully actualized human being. Okay, so we're going to move on to talking about Nietzsche next week, and we'll see that Nietzsche adopts some of Aristotle's views on virtue. See you guys on Monday. Don't forget the last day to change your grading option is Friday at 5, and the last day to drop is Friday at 5.
And she opens it, and the first thing she starts reading is Nietzsche, and she's reading about how she how he's rejecting God. She's a Christian.
Oh,
I feel so sad for
you. Oh, is this somebody that I've seen?
Oh, no.
I'm going to have to chop this out of the recording.
Most of the time people remember him for that quote.
No, my mother.